Good evening, this is Resonance 104.4 FM and you're listening to Little Atoms. Little Atoms is a show about ideas. Each show features a guest from the worlds of science, journalism, politics, academia, human rights or the arts in conversation, and these conversations normally coalesce around ideas to do with the Enlightenment. I'm Neil Denny and our guest tonight is the writer Toby Young. Toby Young is a journalist, author and critic. Currently Associate Editor of The Spectator, Toby founded the short-lived Modern Review with Julie Burchill. After the magazine's closure, Toby went to New York to work for Vanity Fair. His failure to make it as a glossy magazine journalist is documented in his best-selling memoir, How to Lose Friends and Alienate People. Toby's latest book is The Sound of No Hands Clapping, which details Toby's failure to make it as a Hollywood screenwriter. Despite this, How to Lose Friends and Alienate People is currently being made into a Hollywood film, starring Simon Pegg as Toby. This interview was recorded earlier today over the telephone, and I hope you enjoy it. Toby, thanks for agreeing to talk to Little Atoms today.
No problem.
You've just released a new book called The Sound of No Hands Clapping, which features as one of its sort of themes your attempts to make it as a screenwriter in Hollywood. Almost coincidentally, at the same time, while this has been out, the reality is that your first book, How to Lose Friends and Alienate People, is actually being made into a film. So I wonder if you'd like to tell us something about how that's going and what your experiences of that are.
Sure. Well, when I initially did the deal with Stephen Woolley, who's producing How to Lose Friends, he hired me to adapt it for the screen as well.
Uh-huh.
You know, I met with a number of producers, and he was easily the most impressive, largely because he was so incredibly flattering about the book. You know, described it as the catch-22 of his generation and said that, you know, I'm such a gifted writer, I was clearly the guy to adapt it for the screen. I thought, fantastic, you know, you've got a deal. And in Hollywood, there's this adage, which is, the first meeting is always the best.
Uh-huh.
Okay, second meeting with Stephen Woolley. I go to his office at 4:30. I've just turned in a treatment of the screenplay I proposed to write. And his second assistant explains that he's in a meeting with Terry Gilliam and he may be a little delayed. If I just pull my heels in the corridor, he'll be along shortly. Okay, so I'm sitting in the corridor 45 minutes later at a quarter past five. His first assistant pops her head out of the door and says, listen, Stephen's not going to be able to get to you today, but he just wants you to know you're off the picture. He's read the treatment. You're off.
Excellent.
And so that was so that
he
a pretty brutal awakening.
Wasn't such of a fan of Catch-22 after all.
I'm sure he potentially would have hired Joseph Heller to adapt it for the film.
So what's your involvement been since?
Well, my involvement has gradually been downgraded to almost no involvement whatsoever. I did visit the set a couple of times when the film was being shot. And naturally, I couldn't resist taking the director, you know, aside and giving him a few notes on the scene I'd seen him shooting.
No doubt he appreciated that.
Oh, hugely. And it actually is really frustrating being on the set because, you know, the saying is that being on the set of a film that you've written is like being a husband in a delivery suite. But, you know, I didn't even write the film. I wrote the book the film is based on. So I'm like the husband's best mate in the delivery suite trying to give the midwife instructions on how to deliver the baby. And she just doesn't want me in there. So I quickly realized that if I did hang around on the set like a bad smell, that I just antagonize, or at least antagonize them even more than I have already. I stayed well away.
Plus, inevitably, you're going to see the changes that have to be made to these things, and are going to feel sort of proprietary over the writing as well.
Yeah, I mean, I can't say I'm at all unhappy. I mean, it's Bob Whitey, the director. His main claim to fame is having directed and produced about half the episodes of Curb Your Enthusiasm, which is a great show.
Fantastic.
And Simon Pegg has been cast as me, Kirsten Dunst as my girlfriend, Jeff Bridges as my boss, Gillian Anderson as a fearsome PR lady, Megan Fox as the woman I lust after but don't nail. It's great. I mean, no author could hope for, a better team of people to turn their book into a film.
So you have actually got a part, haven't you? You've got a small part?
I flew out to New York for my quote-unquote cameo. I think the only reason the director included my cameo is so he can have the sadistic pleasure of leaving it on the cutting room floor. And in fact, I saw a cut of the film earlier today, and I swear to God, if you blinked, you miss me. And I'm not exaggerating. I'm in the background of this party scene, and literally, I'm the only person who'll be able to spot me, and that's probably a good thing.
So let's, as I said, you've got some sort of insight into that whole world of what's going on over there, because you spent a while over in LA trying to sort of make it as a scriptwriter, which is what the sound of no hands clapping is about. So perhaps you'd like to tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, I went. I got a call in 2002 as I was driving to a wedding in Norfolk, and the person on the other end identified themselves as one of the kind of two or three biggest producers in Hollywood. And of course, I thought it was a crank call. I thought it was my friend Sean winding me up, and I'm like, Sean, you'll have to do a much better American accent like that. And then you sound like you work in like some dairy farm in New Jersey, and the guy's like, no, it really is me, and it really was him, and he. He'd read my book, incredibly, How to Lose Friends. He was on a yacht off the coast of Antibes, and he was bored out of his skull and found my book under a kind of throw cushion and read it from cover to cover, and called me as soon as he got, back to shore. And he flew me out to Nice, and we had this kind of four-hour meeting at the Hotel de Cap in what he described as Sam Spiegel's cabana. And by the end of the meeting, he had hired me to write a picture for him. It was amazing, kind of, dream come true for me. And, of course, it all went totally pear-shaped. But, I mean, I moved out to L.A. thinking, within months I was going to be surrounded by hot and cold running servants, driving a Bentley. I was going to be, Dudley Moore in 10, basically. But with a wife rather than Bo Derek. And it all went just horribly wrong. I mean, I turned in the screenplay and never heard from him again. I ended up having to stalk him through the streets of L.A. to try and just get a response out of him. It's all documented in the book.
Well, that's it. I mean, you say you turned in a screenplay, but a lot of the book is basically about your failure to write anything or inability to come up with any of the treatments in any of the time scale.
Yeah, I'm a real procrastinator. It takes me 2 weeks to come up with Untitled at the top of the page. I actually haven't given up wanting to be a screenwriter. In fact, I've just finished a second draft of a screenplay, and I still entertain hopes of selling it someday.
Well, presumably that will be a little easier now. Yeah, now that the film's going to come out, and presumably it's going to be a
Yeah, well,
huge
I'm
success.
I'm hoping to hoodwink people into thinking that I did write it.
Yeah, that you had something to do with it.
I mean, it's got some other guy's name on it, but it's basically all me. So hopefully if the film's successful, and I can perpetrate that con, I may yet pick up a bit of screenwriting work.
So I mean, Simon Pegg is presumably going to be able to portray you in quite a sympathetic light. He's a great actor.
Yeah, I mean, funnily enough, I've just come from a screening theatre, and he doesn't, it's very much a warts and all portrait. He doesn't try and kind of sugar the pill in any way at all. In fact, I interviewed him for the Culture Show on the Beeb. It hasn't yet been broadcast yet, but when I was in New York doing my cameo, and I said to him, what's it like for someone who's universally loved to play someone universally loathed? And he said, well, actually, it was quite tough at first to get my head around it, but then I met you and it all fell into place. And he really, he's done a terrific job of making me pretty loathsome.
Well, that's, I mean, presumably that's sort of part of the success of the book, because if it was just a exploration of somebody going off to New York and trying to work for a magazine, that wouldn't be particularly of any interest, would it? And surely the success of the book is how you've done this remarkable thing of coming across as a likeable, loathsome person.
Yeah, well, I think in the book, one of the reasons I managed to pull off that sleight of hand is because it's me kind of confessing to all these incredibly loathsome antics.
Yeah.
But I don't get points for that in the film. I mean, there's no voiceover. It's just this loathsome character doing appalling things. He's not quite as sympathetic, I don't think, as I am in the book, even though it's Simon Pegg-Plamey, but that could be just me.
You've actually you've played yourself on stage in a production, did that?
No, I adapted the book for the stage along with a playwright called Tim Fountain, and the idea was initially that I would play myself, but after the producer saw me doing a run-through, she took me to one side and said, "You're really good, but I think it might be even better if we hired a professional actor to play the lead part." And actors have this expression about other actors. They say, "He's so bad, he couldn't even get a job playing himself." And in my case, that was literally
true.
Yeah. And when I sort of started humming and hawing to the girl and kind of making self-deprecating noises, the producer, she said, no, it's not that you were poor. It's just that many of the people who come to see plays are young single women, and what they like is a bit of eye candy on the stage. It's someone they can imagine themselves with. In other words, I wasn't good looking enough to play myself. Anyway, so Jack Davenport was initially hired to play me, and he did a terrific job, and he did it for 3 weeks at the Soho Theatre, and it did well enough for us to then get a berth in the West End for 6 weeks. But we just couldn't, for love or money, find an actor willing to take on the role in the West End. I mean, it was too much exposure. Mm-hmm. And so I did end up playing myself then, and that was a nerve-wracking experience, having never kind of done anything on stage before. I remember the second time I did it, my wife came to see me doing it. She came to see Jack Davenport doing it three times, and he came to see me doing it once, and I'm not making that up. But this was the one and only time she came to see me do it. And I looked up at her for about 10 minutes and saw her face kind of peering up at me, and suddenly couldn't remember what my next line was. And so I walked around the stage, hoping that I could sort of make it look as all part of the show, and kind of came back to the spot I'd been at, and then just repeated the previous line I had been able to remember, which virtually made things 100 times worse, because now everyone in the audience, including my wife, who had her head in her hands, knew that I'd forgotten my lines. And I then had to conquer this overwhelming urge to just kind of run into the wings, screaming, "I'm not an actor, I can't do this." So I just skipped to the next bit of the play I could remember. But because I couldn't remember what I hadn't been able to remember, I didn't know how much I'd left out. And I thought, yeah, this is going to be, it's going to end in 10 minutes. So people are going to be looking at their watches thinking, 20 minutes? That was a little bit quick. I paid £40 for this.
Changing the subject completely, I want to talk about social networking and the social networking in the internet age, more specifically. As of about half an hour ago, you've got just shy of 900 Facebook friends, Toby. So do you ever turn anyone down?
No. No, anyone wants to be my friend, I'm so flattered, I immediately say yes. And I've now got, you know, almost 900, which is, you know, I feel loved finally.
So what do you think of this sort of phenomenon of these sites? You wrote quite an interesting article about a survey that's been done comparing Facebook to MySpace.
Yeah, the Facebook is you and MySpace is non-you, which was a distinction that Nancy Mitford made famous in her famous essay in Encounter. You standing for upper class and non-you for non-upper class. But I think there is a slight social distinction between MySpace and Facebook, but I think it's blurring. What happens is when a social networking site suddenly kind of hits public consciousness, there are kind of early adopters who tend to be kind of a little more sophisticated and kind of tech savvy, and then the kind of hoi polloi then crowd in and they move on. I'm not sure how much longer Facebook's actually got in the spotlight. By the time this is broadcast, it may well have metamorphosized into the equivalent of MySpace. If I was the owner of Facebook, I'd probably be looking to, you know, accept those offers rather than wait in the hope that it'll be worth twice as much next year.
Well, something that seems to have happened with Facebook that's never really happened before is it's you know, there are, although there's loads of celebrities on there where it isn't really them, but there are plenty where there are. We yourself being one of those examples, and this has not really happened before, and it's almost like there's some sort of democratization going on with it, that, you know, you can be friends and people can really genuinely feel that, because you do get some sort of interaction. So if you are one of your friends on Facebook, you know, because you're going in and updating
I think it's slightly misleading. I think when you become, I'm friends with lots of kind of quote unquote celebrities on Facebook, but I think 99 out of 100 are just kind of, you know, people masquerading. You know, I'm friends with Angelina Jolie and I flirted with her on Facebook, but actually it's probably some, you know, some fat bloke in Wandsworth. He's just got lots of pictures to put up. And I think in those rare instances where it isn't someone masquerading as a celebrity, it probably is just the celebrity's assistant masquerading as their employer, you know,
in a promotional way.
I mean, actually, I'm not in any sense a real Facebook celebrity because I haven't got any impersonators. I mean, I'll know I've arrived when I've got a kind of several people pretending to be me on Facebook.
A fat bloke in Wonder.
Watchdog recently kind of caught me in a sting operation.
And I wanted to come on to this, so yeah, tell us about that.
Well, someone calling themselves Amber Friend, i.e. a friend, applied to be my friend on Facebook. And when I said yes, without kind of in any way kind of grilling her, I was then contacted by Watchdog saying, "We have successfully gained access to your personal details on Facebook and could now fake your identity and drain all your money out of all your bank accounts. Would you like to come and talk about this lapse in security on Watchdog?" And I went on to Watchdog and to talk about it, and it was ludicrous, really, because, you know, I mean, I'd love it if someone started to impersonate me. That would be a sign I've arrived. You know, I can't wait for that to happen. You know, identity theft, bring it on. So it didn't go quite according to plan from their point of view.
The joke of this is, you know, that you don't have your bank account details on there or anything.
But they could find out where you've been to school, what your wife's name is. Like, yeah, well, I've written two volumes of memoirs. They could find that out pretty easily going into any bookshop. It's not like I'm a retiring violet.
So you don't think it offers any danger?
I don't know. I mean, you know, given that the government is virtually hawking people's bank account details on every street corner, I mean, it seems unlikely that Facebook poses much of a security risk.
Well, there's been, in, I don't know if you've caught this week, there's been this sort of interesting case where a guy who's a blogger who has stood for Labour candidacy in the past has basically gone into the Facebook page of the daughter of Nadine Dorries, the Conservative MP, and picked up a bad word that she said on there and has sort of publicised this in an extremely underhand and slimy way. And so I suppose that there are sort of dangers that lurk there that I suppose are only ever gonna come out learn from it.
Well, I think in general, though, I think you know, privacy concerns are misplaced. I mean, I think, you know, most people are concerned about people not knowing enough about them.
Sure, indeed,
Not kind of anyone finding stuff out about them. I think that's kind of like belongs to a sort of pre-internet era.
Yeah, that,
people are on
yeah.
Facebook, they've got their photos on there, and they've got all these incredible reams and reams of details about themselves, you know. And they've got blogs, and they're on MySpace too. I mean, everyone's kind of, you know, hanging out a billboard for themselves these days. I don't think anyone's concerned about their privacy being invaded.
No, I agree with that entirely. It seems to be that there's been a lot of writing recently about, like, older people writing about these young people who just don't have any concept of the idea of sort of secrecy, and that, you know, they're just going to roll over when the government take away all our freedoms and stuff, and it's quite silly.
Yeah.
Okay, so I want to talk about another article that you've written, because this is it's something really interesting going on as well. You wrote an article called "No More Films About the War, Please," about how there's been a gamut of Hollywood movies about Iraq, and I'd like to sort of talk around why this is, because it is quite a new phenomenon, and it's probably the first time, even going back to the first Iraq war, back to the Falklands, and then all the way back to Vietnam, and certainly World War II, there's been war films, but they always come along much later, you know, after the war's finished and sort of dealt with in sort of, you know, the Vietnam ones are the classics, which were, you know, Americans finally getting to deal with what had happened in Vietnam, and it took years for, you know, the filmmakers to actually sort of pluck up the courage to sort of deal with that. So why do you think this is going on now?
Well, I think it does sort of reflect the legacy of Vietnam. I think that, you know, many American stars don't want to kind of be seen to be waiting sort of 5 or 10 years before they kind of come out against the war. They want everyone to know that they're against the war right now. You know, they want to kind of shore up their liberal credentials and kind of get on the right side of this one. And I also think that, you know, I think there's a general feeling in Hollywood that one of the reasons Hollywood went through this extraordinary creative period in the late 60s and early 70s was as a result of Vietnam and Watergate, crisis of confidence and so forth. And that they think that if they make films about the war reflecting a kind of current crisis in America, that that those films will be the kind of 21st century equivalent of The Godfather and Apocalypse Now and so forth. I think where they've gone wrong, I mean, there hasn't really been a single good film about the war yet, unless you count The 300, which I quite like, which was the only pro-war Hollywood film to be made so far about the war, but only very indirectly. I think the reason they're so poor is because they're all actually about, very explicitly, the war, and they're based on, like, real events. You know, Redacted, for instance, Brian De Palma's film, is based on a real event in which a platoon raped a 14-year-old Iraqi girl and there were attempts made to cover it up and so forth. But that's actually a kind of rather cack-handed approach, I think, to tackling the subject. It's far too direct. If you look at all the best films which reflected that national unease in the 70s, like The Conversation, for instance.
Sure.
The Conversation was patently about Watergate, but it was very indirectly about Watergate. It was a metaphor. Even MASH, the most famous film to be made about the Vietnam War, wasn't in fact about the Vietnam War, it was about the war in Korea. And it's as though kind of they're so unimaginative, this current generation of kind of liberal Hollywood stars and filmmakers, that they can't actually create a convincing and powerful metaphor to express their misgivings about the war in Iraq. It's just films about the war in Iraq.
Was there not a case, though, where, I mean, even the sort of late 60s, early 70s, when the sort of great films we're talking about were being made, which was the sort of, you know, after the, you know, the beginning of the permissive age and people sort of throwing off the sort of shackles of censorship that had gone before. Do you not think there's perhaps a sort of self-censorship in a lot of those sort of filmmakers about making films that weren't directly about this sort of events have happened? I mean, there were lots of films about, be it the Parallax View or The Conversation, as you said, which are about that Watergate era, but there was never any that sort of dealt directly with it. And I wonder if we just, people had, that's just disappeared completely now. I mean, there was this a British television programme called The Mark of Cain a few weeks ago, and there was a sort of controversy about it, that being that should we be showing this sort of thing that's implicitly criticising the conduct of the war because it could be used as a sort of propaganda tool. I mean, do you think there's any truth in that?
Well, I don't think that the reason the films that have so far been made, whether in Britain or America, about the war have been so poor is because the filmmakers themselves have been kind of inhibited about being too critical of the troops or their kind of political backers. I mean, quite the contrary. They've been one-sided, certainly, but very much from a critical point of view. I mean, I think the poverty of the films reflect a general trend in the culture, which puts too great a premium on verisimilitude. You know, documentaries are now prized more highly than features, non-fiction more highly than fiction, reality shows are more popular than drama shows, and so on and so forth. People think that if something's going to have any power dramatically, it has to, in some sense, be real. And if it's not explicitly real, it has to be based on real events. And if it's not actually based on real events, it has to sort of seem like these things actually could have happened. And I think that's a mistake. You know, I think the more indirect, the more metaphorical, the more invented and imaginative the vehicle for conveying your ideas is, the much more likely they are to be successful.
Well, do you think that's out of that sort of phenomenon that you just talked about comes this same thing that's happening now, where people are going crazy about TV being sort of unrealistic? In, I mean, I'm not talking about the sort of Anton Deck phone line type stuff, but this ridiculous things with, like, oh, Gordon Ramsay didn't really catch this fish, and the sort of, I mean, you actually talk about this, the noise.
Yeah, well, I think people are kind of waking up to the fact that reality programs are as carefully scripted as drama programs, and in fact, you know, it's idiotic, really, that anyone should be remotely surprised by.
Sure.
I mean, of course, you know, the events are kind of completely stunted up and not kind of remotely authentic or genuine. And I guess perhaps that will kind of... I mean, we could go in either one of two directions now. We could either kind of make kind of much more kind of ethical reality programs in which, you know, there's much less kind of producer interference, much less kind of sculpting and moulding of storylines. But that's unlikely to happen, it seems to me, because those programs wouldn't be too boring. You know, you just might as well sit and watch people walking by on the street. So hopefully what it will lead to will be a kind of a resurgence in genuine drama.
There's, I mean, one of the programs that's on at the moment, which is great, I absolutely love, is this one with Ewan McGregor and Charlie Borman riding their motorbikes down Africa, and you know, you only have to think about it a moment to think that this is.
Yeah. Of course, they're not in any danger, or not exposed to any risk at all, because they've got a camera crew and several lorries following them everywhere.
But also, presumably, the whole thing is a procession of riding a few hundred yards, getting off the bikes while the cameras catch up,
going into the trailer, getting a blowjob from their girlfriends and wives. Hoofing down cloths of whiskey. Yeah.
But nonetheless, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't make the whole thing any less entertaining. But the idea that people could ever have thought that these sort of things weren't happening is just beyond comprehension, really. Well, we're out of time, so that went incredibly quickly. So thanks very much for speaking to Little Atoms. We'll be right back.